Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. So thank you once again for tuning in for a new year of broadcasts here on CorbettReport.com. It is the 2nd of January 2012 today. And yes, it's going to take some use to getting used to saying that, I guess, because it is already 2012. How the time flies and sneaks up on us. And today we're joined once again by our regular weekly guest, Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster at theinternationalforecaster.com. Bob Chapman, happy new year, and thank you for joining us once again for another year of broadcasts.
Well, thank you. And again, it's very nice to be here in the new year. I rested up last week, so maybe you'll be a little bit better than usual. Most people go out on New Year's Eve. We slept 9 and 10 hours, respectively. So there you go.
And I did myself as well, because I'm just not that exciting, but I am resting up to take on the New World Order for another year. So so it has been a restful week, but there's a lot going on still. So perhaps we should start again with Europe this week.
Well, as my readers know, that having spent many years in Europe, what happens is that they usually shut down from December 7 until about the 10th of the month of January. And there were some things coming out they addressed, surprisingly so. And one was that, and most people even in Europe don't know this, Germany legally lent the European Central Bank about $600 billion. Then there was a swap agreement made between the U.S. Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank. And the reason they did it that way was that it's illegal for them to loan each other money. So by doing a swap, they were able to avoid that. It's a technicality. It's against the spirit of both the regulations affecting both entities, we'll call them. And so what is a swap? A swap is the Federal Reserve creates money out of thin air. And they, in turn, send that digital money or put it on an account for the European Central Bank. The European Central Bank does the same thing that they do in euros. Will the Fed spend the euros? Maybe. But that's not what the exercise is about. It's about liquefying, bailing out the entities of Europe. What are those entities? Sovereign governments and banks. Others too, but we won't go into them. How much was involved? We don't know. My sources have told me $1 trillion. Now, if you take the $600 billion, which is supposed to be used, that the Germans gave to the ECB, it's supposed to be used to offset the financial problems of the six sovereign nations which are in trouble. And I suppose that'll hold them for a while. $600 billion, probably 6 months, maybe even a year. But we'll say 6 months to be conservative. On the other hand, the trillion, where did that go? Or where will it go? The $1 trillion has been meted out so far to 523 banks. How much have they gotten? About $600 billion of that trillion. And what are they doing with the money for the time being? They're sending it back to the ECB and saying, you hold that for me. We're going to decide what we're going to do with it. My figure was wrong there. It wasn't $600 billion they gave back to the ECB. It was about $460 billion. So obviously they kept part of it to do what they had to do with that money, whatever it may be. Now that money is not only to bail the banks out and go onto their balance sheets in particular, but it's also to bail out or to be used in conjunction with hedge funds and others who want to speculate and manipulate the markets. By manipulating the markets higher, the value of things go higher, profits go higher, and that offsets the losses that the banks have already made. All those banks are broke. This is a Ponzi scheme, no question. So that is the situation financially at the moment that they're into. Now, the question comes up here, why did they do it that way? They did it that way because it was against the Maastricht Treaty of 1991-92, which brought into being eventually the Eurozone, which was the idea of the Germans, incidentally, and the Euro. They wanted to get as much control as they could upon the commerce of Europe, we'll put it that way. And the other treaty was the Lisbon Treaty, which was signed about a year and a half or two ago, and it was just shoved down everybody's throats. And under those regulations with those treaties, they were unable to do it. And they want to amend them, which they're going to attempt to do if they get the time to do it. And I think they might get the time to do it. They want to change them. On the other hand, you get 65% of the people in Germany say, no, we don't want that anymore. We're sick and tired of lending these people money. They don't change their lifestyle. They don't increase their productivity. They just kind of roll around from one day to the next as far as Northern Europeans are concerned. And you got to understand the cultures and, quite frankly, animosity between both of them. I mean, I've lived all over the continent and speak their languages, and those from the north, when they visit the south, act like the masters of the universe, we'll call him, in a way. And so it's this haughty attitude that the Southerners don't like, but they need the business. And the Southerners make very little attempt to speak the languages of the North, which is rather surprising. I mean, I've stayed in places like Portugal and parts of Spain and France, and nobody speaks English. Nobody speaks German. I once met a man, and he stopped me. I was driving in Albufeira, which is on the Algarve in southern Portugal, and it's a very famous resort city, and during the summertime, that is. Anyway, the fellow flags me down, and he says to me in German, can you give me directions? And I answered him, and I said, yeah, no problem. Where do you want to go? And he said, oh, my goodness, you speak German. He says, I haven't met anybody here yet except other Germans happen to be floating around that speak German. And that's the kind of dichotomy you find south versus north. Just a small thing. But here I am, a foreigner, trying to help this guy, but nobody locally can. And so with that said, people should understand there's a great deal of difference in the cultures of the North and the South. I call it an unnatural association. They have nothing in common, really, culturally. And socially, there's a difference. They're still human beings. Everybody acts to the same things, the way they react and responses and so on and so forth. And so I think that people should keep this in mind when they try to put some sort of a test to what's going to happen in Europe. It's very difficult. Right now, I'm trying to figure out, and, you know, I don't have the answers for everything either. And I'm trying to find out what the Germans are up to. Do they want to do away with the euro? Or do they want to keep it? Do they want to keep the euro and keep the European Union? Or do they want to get rid of the union, the euro, and keep the European Union? Tremendously mixed signals. It's one of the few times I've really been stuck on something in a long, long time. And you see this tremendous tranche of money coming in. You know, the Federal Reserve can do that ad infinitum, forever and ever. So you say, well, when is Europe going to get in trouble? When people are no longer willing throughout the world, and particularly in Europe and the United States, to take dollars. So we could be down the line another 5 years. I don't know. I don't know what black swan events or untoward events are going to happen. I don't think most other people do either. So I'm trying to analyze what's going on in there. But I do know one thing. Europe has bought a year. They were headed into, and strongly, headed into a recession. This will reverse that, this money that's going to be floating around. And that money will slosh over into England as well into the United States, which will help their economies. How much remains to be seen. England, I would think it would allow them to gain 1% of GDP. The U.S., because of the vastness of the economy, maybe 1 to 1.5%. Now, before that, I had a minus 1.5%. Before that, they, the bankers in New York, were talking at about a plus 1.5%. I don't think they're right. So we're going to get, during this coming year, an increase in GDP of 1.5%, maybe 2 to 2.5%, based upon the sloshing over of some of those funds into the U.S., into the banking system of the United States. Can't be helped. And relatively the same with England. And so the current amount of money that we're talking about is 1.6 trillion. Now, what I haven't mentioned to you, and most people don't know this, they don't think about it, there's a thing called fractional banking. Now, the $1 trillion that's been loaned to the ECB via swap by the Federal Reserve, on a prudent basis, can be increased to 14.5, which would be $1.45 trillion. And, excuse me, $14.5 trillion. That's enough money to keep going, or Europe going, for the next 5 years or 10 years. So we don't know how much money they're going to spend, how much money is going to be leveraged by using a prudent historical indicator of 9 to 1. They may not use it at all. On the other hand, they may take it up to 30 to 1 for all we know. But this thing is open-ended. And so those who think there's going to be a deflationary environment, they better forget it. I mean, they've thrown everything in but the kitchen sink. And I guess they threw their hands in the air and said, look, we can't do this, that, and the other thing. So what we're going to do is this. And that's what they've done. So that means for Americans, the majority who listen to these broadcasts, that means that you're going to have a half-decent year that you didn't expect. As far as I know, I'm the only person who analyzes these things that's come up with this. And I think I'll be right on it. Will they leverage it? I don't know. Probably. And will it solve the problems? Absolutely not. The majority of the money created by the Federal Reserve, which is some $1 to $9 trillion, that will stay within the banking system, hedge funds, institutional. It's not going into the economy per se to create jobs. The other $600 billion, which has been given to the ECB by the Germans, that will go to bail out those countries on a short-term basis. A good part of it will be used to offset debt that's coming due, rolling the debt, as it's called. So that means that you probably will have a sideways movement in the United States in the economy that may be slightly higher, but probably about the same as it was this past year. What does that leave us? It leaves us with 22.6% unemployment. It's not going to change. They're making no efforts that can create jobs anywhere. And, you know, how can you create jobs, especially in Europe, when you have austerity programs going? I mean, you have to be dumb to understand or not understand that that's what's happening. They're trying to get their balance sheets together. Spain's a good example right now. They're scrambling. A good thing for Spain is their public debt as a percentage of GDP is probably 30 to 40%, which is very low compared to all the other countries. I mean, the U.S. is over 80, as an example. Germany's over 80, which is dreadful. Anyway, they're trying to haul everything in Spain and get their lives straightened out. But, you know, who's going to live in all those empty houses that are there? And you're not aware of it, but in the interim, over the past few years, there's been a major scandal in Spain about builders building on public property and not telling the buyers of the homes. And what's happened is a lot of people from Europe and the United Kingdom who bought homes in that area don't own them. The municipality or the county or the province or the state or whatever, they own them. And so there's a big scandal. And most of it's passed. I mean, the damage has been done. But how do you create jobs when you have that kind of a problem? And nobody has any faith. Who's going to come in and buy those houses? It's certainly not going to be the Spanish people, because they mostly generally, most of them have houses that can afford houses. The foreigners aren't coming back to buy. They've been burned once. They're not going to come back again. So what do you do with them? Well, I don't know, but I do know that's the situation in Spain. And so you have different things like that all over Europe. And it's going to be a very, very hard, arduous, long road back. And what is Germany going to do? You know, if they do away with the euro, and this is very important, think about this. The G20 agreement is broken, as well as the two treaties, Maastricht and Lisbon. And the question is Germany going to get you rid of the euro? Maybe. I would think probably. And are they prepared to pay higher tariffs to all of the countries that formerly they didn't have to pay tariffs to? You know, Germany had a sweetheart deal that extended beyond the European Union in regard to tariffs. And this is very, very important, because at G20 meeting that was held several years ago, gave Germany license to be able there to sell their products cheaply. Something that they theretofore had not had the opportunity to do. And that means that the World Trade Organization, which fits into this scheme, it means that they have to probably break up, because one of their key members, which is the which is Germany, won't be in the fold anymore. And quite frankly, this is the best thing that could ever happen to England, the United States, etc., because it would break the back of NAFTA. And it would allow the American government, through legislation, to say, we're going to enact tariffs on goods and services just like everybody else is. And that would, if the tax-free status of earnings offshore, if that's done away with by legislature, and this is something Ron Paul would do as president, then they would set up a balanced field of play for everybody to play by. And the United States would be in a position where they could say to companies, look, the advantages that you have are gone. Why don't you come home? And if the tariffs are set properly, it will not be, well, it will be as profitable to go into production at home as it would be, say, in China, which is a big exporter. We'll use them. And so there's big changes coming, and that could really resurrect the American economy, because the United States has been operating at a tremendous disadvantage. We've lost 12 million jobs in 12 years in 450,000 businesses, most of them factories. Now, you say, well, how can people catch up after 10 years? Well, you can. If you don't have the skills necessary to, say, build a better mousetrap, well, you go to China and bring somebody in over that knows how to do it, and they'll do that. So we're looking at a very complex picture here, which could very well come about here in the next couple of years. And so if Germany breaks up the Eurozone, even though they stay in the EU, and there's tremendous political pressure for them to do so from the German people, the only real way that they can make up for the loss, advantage that they have in trade, they would have to increase productivity. Now, productivity in the United States since World War II has increased 2.5% annually on average. They would have to increase something on the order of 4 to 5% over a number of years. And so I think that there's going to be massive changes that nobody expects. And they could be very beneficial to the United States. And I live with the Germans. I know the Germans. They'll catch up. They're pretty good at it. And they'd hold their position perhaps not as firmly as before, but I think they could do that. So this is the evolutionary process that we're in right now with Europe, UK, US, And the only countries that have really done well are those producing natural resources. And we're talking about Australia, Canada, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Mexico. And so they've done quite well because of natural resources. It doesn't, you know, have to be oil. It can be other things as well. And so I think that's where this whole thing is headed. And it'll take a while. But I think that the possibilities of major changes are coming this year. And we'll just have to see how they develop.
Well, just an incredible amount of things to pick up from there. But to go back to one of the main points there, you're saying that basically like a junkie getting his fix, that this $1 trillion loan is going to tide the economy over for another year?
If not more, because we don't know how much they're going to leverage it. It's not the ECB, it's the banks. If the ECB gets on the phone and calls 523 banks and says, okay, we want you to use 3-to-1 leverage, they'll do it. Pretty simple.
Exactly right. So just like everything else in this House of Cards economy, it's all just based on whatever gambling rules they want to institute at the casino. So they get to choose the rules. Well, that's interesting. But of course, there is a wild card in the entire mix here, which is that we are coming up on an election year. In fact, we're already in it, aren't we? So so by the end of the year, there will be a newly or could be a newly elected president, or we could be suffering from 4 more years of Obama. So what do you think that wild card out there might possibly do to change this outlook for the coming year?
Well, I think a good many people, first of all, with Mr. Obama, I think his solid front of maybe 95% is in the black community is weakening. They're not happy at all with his performance in relation to them. I mean, he's working for the bankers, not for them, and they expected something for them and others. It hasn't come. He's got very low ratings, and so he's going to have to fight his way back, so to speak. As far as the ratings are concerned, with the people going into the Iowa caucuses tomorrow, the Republican National Party, which counts these votes, is because they say the Occupy movement's going to be in town during that day, that they have to take all the ballots to a secret place and count them. Well, you know what that means. They're going to rig the election. My sources on the inside tell me that Ron Paul has over 50% right now, which is overwhelming lead. They'll either try to cut him back to losing by 1% or put him in a dead heat with Romney. And that is a probable expectation. And, you know, these Republicans don't get it. They're running around saying that we're going to solve your problems, and everybody who's running has been bought and paid for by banking and Wall Street. And the public realize that. The public knows. Not all of them, but enough of them.
And more every day, I think. But I thought there was an interesting thing that you pointed out in the forecaster that was released on New Year's Eve, that the Ed Show on MSNBC began, I guess, a new MSNBC policy of admitting that MSNBC is tied to Bain Capital, the buyout firm co-founded by Mitt Romney, which is a little tidbit that I had not seen anywhere else. So that was very interesting to find out. Not surprising, but interesting.
Well, he's made a fortune tied to Wall Street. It's as simple as that. And he tries to hide that fact. He's a speculator. And there's a long history on Romney and his family and others. And I won't get into it because it's too extensive. All I can tell you is they're all bought and paid for, unless Ron, with the exception of Ron Paul. And if Ron Paul is not elected, you people are doomed. Because no matter which Republican or Democrat is elected, they'll be bought and paid for. None of the changes that are necessary to change America will be done. If Ron Paul is elected, he will get rid of the Federal Reserve as fast as possible. The executive order called the President's Working Group in Financial Markets extremely important, because they're the ones that are rigging the markets all the time, and they won't tell us what they're doing. And you only have that in secret societies or secret governments or dictatorships or things like that. And there's a whole litany of things that can be changed, and it can be changed quickly. And if you don't get Ron Paul in there, there's not going to be any changes. I mean, we can segue right into the National Military Appropriations Act. There's an acronym for it. Do you know what it is?
The NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act.
The NDAA. Now, not only did that piece of legislation the past a few weeks ago was signed, and Senator Levin was one of the co-sponsors, and he said the section that pertained to American citizens being picked up as terrorists without charges was put in by the White House. And so they can go up and pick you up anywhere, and let's say that Mrs. Jones says at a council meeting in up the creek, Missouri, or someplace, says, I think the President of the United States is doing a terrible job, and I'd like to find a way to get him out of office. Well, the woman leaves the meeting. The military is outside, picks her up. She disappears, never to be heard from again. That's what they can do to American citizens under that proviso. And even more disgusting is that they also put in there, in that legislation, the advancement of homosexuality within the military, and it approved bestiality by military personnel in their own quarters. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. I was on with Alex Jones on Friday, like I am every Friday, and I said, Alex, I've never heard of it. I can't believe it. It is just unbelievable. And so with that said, the next program that came on had Max Geiser, and he says, I agree with Bob Chapman. He says, I'm so thunderstruck. I can't believe it's in the legislation. I don't know what to say.
And let me just chime in on that as well, because until you mentioned it just before we went on air, I had never heard of that either, and I couldn't believe it. And I just did a quick search for it, and here on militarygear.com from December 20th, they have an article about bestiality and sodomy repeal stripped from NDAA. So there was, in the original draft legislation, a repeal of Article 125 of the UCMJ in the legislation itself, and Article 125 pertains to sodomy, and it actually lists the elements that are applicable here. The accused engaged in unnatural carnal copulation with a certain other person or with an animal, or number two, that the act was done with a child under the age of 16, and three, that the act was done by force and without the consent of the other person. So if I'm reading that correctly, it would actually have repealed the very legislation forbidding bestiality, sodomy, child abuse, and rape. So,
well, pedophilia. Exactly. Is the right term.
Absolutely. I mean, just
unbelievable. If you can believe how depraved these people are in Washington. I mean, Americans, can you get this through your head? I mean, these people are nutty as fruitcakes. And they're dangerous. They're not only sociopaths, they're psychopaths. And they think they're the masters of the universe. They think they're going to be able to help everybody. You've got to be kidding me. I mean, you can imagine the child walking to school gets picked up by one of these freaks. And I can start naming them, believe me. And you don't even want to hear who's involved. And it's going to get worse and worse. And you know, the question came up, why do people do this? People do these things because they have no morality. But more importantly, they tried everything else. They're wealthy, they're the mayor of this city, the governor of that state, or they work for the administration, or they're a bureaucrat, whatever it is. They have taken their carnal desires to the very edge. And now they want to try something new. And there has been, going back almost 100 years in our society, the use of pedophilia has been widespread among those kind of people in those kind of positions. We had scandals during the 20s and 30s and 40s. Boys Town, the things that went on in Nebraska. I can't remember the details because it's been 50 years since I read them. But it's horrible. And it's been going on, and children have been snatched off the street to be turned into prostitutes. And you saw that during the Bush administration when that fellow appeared from nowhere, who, Johnny Gooch or something like that, Gooch, he was one of the kids who was kidnapped and turned into one of those prostitutable people, I guess you'd call it. And so, yes, that's part of the legislation. So, yeah, you know, we need Ron Paul. You need Ron Paul and people like him. If you don't put him in office, you don't even want me to tell you what's going to happen to you.
Well, I wish I could say that you're wrong, but it's something that we've been over on the Corbett Report many times with the Boys Town scandal and James Guckert and all of the strange goings-on at the White House that have been documented even in the Washington Post and other mainstream publications. So it's certainly there, and it just leaves you wondering what it is that constantly attracts these people to pedophilia and things like that. I mean, is it just the need for complete domination over other human beings? I mean, it's almost unthinkable.
Well, there's a number of reasons that I'd rather not get into, because it's really dreadful. We've got the framework for what they're up to, and that's good enough. Just on the face of it, people shouldn't be doing those kind of things in a normal society. And I don't call those kind of things normal. Maybe the pedophiles in Washington and throughout the country do. I mean, you know, it's this man-boy love society that they've got. And incidentally, the guy that finances all of that is the guy that financed Occupy through the Tides Foundation.
Small world after all. It's just moving
it
in the same
is.
Circles, isn't it? Absolutely, just appalling, sickening. I mean, there are no words for it, and that's really what's at stake when we're talking about fighting against this system. So I hope people out there really do understand what it is we're fighting against, and what depends on our ability to truly fight off this system.
Well, it's another facet of things that the American public are going to have to deal with. They've been looking the other way for too long. They have said, well, let Joe fix it. Or they've said, it's none of my business, it's not affecting my life, I don't care. Well, that's not true any longer. It's at your doorstep. Next, they'll be teaching children in school that it's all right for little boys and girls to have anal sex at 10 and 11 years old. Get ready for it. It's coming. It goes all the way back to Cicus in the early 1960s in that formation. And so, with that said, I think that there's a lot of problems out there, and I think our passing that information on to you is important, because now you can see what level they've fallen to. And are they maintain themselves at, let's put it that way. It's just another reason for you to get working for Ron Paul, who's a decent human being. He's our only chance. And if you don't take it, and if you don't put him in office, you're probably going to become enslaved or leave the United States, one or the other. Other societies are not going through that presently that I know about. And there's some of it in Europe, but so far it's been euthanasia. And the attitude in Europe is that they're older and they're sick, let them die. Now, that brings me to something that in our next issue we have a link in. There was a tape from Mark Levin's show at us in Chicago on last Thursday or Friday, and a man who said he was a surgeon called in. Now, this is another subject, but it shows you the connection. And the man said, I've just come from Washington. I am a surgeon. And he said, I had to study 9 years after I finished, you know, my internship to do that. And I went to Washington to see what they were going to do under the new legislation. It's coming up 1 year from now and the following year. And he said, the first thing is they're calling people, not patients, they're calling them units. He was very specific on that. And anybody who has to be treated has to be approved by a panel. The panel has absolutely no medical experience whatsoever. And they're going to decide with people over 70 whether they're going to live or die. These are the death panels that we've talked about for so long. And he says, the surgeon, well, what happens when I'm in the emergency room at 2 a.m. and a case comes in and it's someone who is, well, 76 like I am, and has just had an aneurysm, do I treat him or do I wait for the panel to form 7 or 8 hours from now? And of course, if he waits, the patient will probably die. So he's got to go ahead and break the rules to save this man's life. And even after he saves it, the panel may say, well, you saved his life, it's okay. You did what you thought was right. We don't agree with it. We can put you in jail for it, which is true. But let's just let him die. It's easier. So what it is, it's a culling process of doing away with elderly people who have things wrong with them, and sooner or later, in old age, you're going to have something go wrong. I mean, it is inevitable. The human body or mind breaks down. And you all know of innumerable experiences. So that's what they got in store for you under Medicare and Medicaid. It doesn't apply if you have private insurance, like all our politicians. But it applies to all federal employees, state employees, because they are getting their medical care through an overall system, as opposed to having private insurance. And I've talked to innumerable medical people, doctors, and they have all told me that through early retirement, you'll either be to be doctors, ladies and gentlemen, in their late 50s through their 60s, who will say, "I'm not gonna let people die. I'm out of here." And then there'll be the ones that say, "I'm not gonna take those fees that they're offering us, which are one third or one half of what we're getting now through the nationalization of doctors and then nurses programs." And they're gonna quit. We're gonna lose 30% of medical personnel. Now I ask you, you go to the hospital for emergency and ain't nobody there. In your area, wherever that may be, the only hospital has emergency on is 30 miles away. So off you go. You go down there and they say, "Oh, Mr. Chapman, you had an aneurysm, but we can't treat you until tomorrow. So, you know, we'll put you on whatever you need, and they'll decide tomorrow at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning whether you're going to live or die." So get it through your heads. Anybody over 60, you're fair game. Over 70, it's curtains. You want to avoid it? You've got to give up Medicare and Medicaid. You got to leave the country. Whatever you're going to do. Other countries don't do that. Holland does it. England does it. But for the most part, most of them don't, particularly Catholic countries, countries that have been had Catholicism as religion for a long, long time, and that's a very strong ethic there, and they're going to have a heck of a time breaking that down. But the point is, this is where this is headed, and I don't make up fairy tales. This is for your own good, so you got to start thinking. Ron Paul will not let that happen. There's a whole host of things that have to be changed. And he'll have 4 and maybe 8 years to do it. But you've got to get him into office. Financially, you've got to help him. We just raised $4 million the other day, which was terrific. So he can make a stand in Iowa. And we got to keep on doing that because he doesn't have Lloyd Blankfein and all these other characters in the banks in New York and the brokerage firms supplying him with endless amounts of money like his opponents are getting. We got to work hard, and you've got to elect him. A life of, as you have known it, is over.
Right, and continue to support him once he's gotten into office, and to continue the real work that will have to go on at the state level and the local level. And of course, for people all around the world, not only taking what Ron Paul is doing as an inspiration, but running with it in your own countries as perhaps, hopefully, a sign that something can change this year. And this has not been a very a heartwarming conversation in a lot of ways tonight, but if there's anything that we can take out of this on a positive note, it's that we do still have the power to change this world for the better, and hopefully that's what we're working toward, or at least towards the beginning of that in 2012. So on that note, let's let people know about the International Forecaster and how they can get their hands on a copy.
Well, the Forecaster is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues throughout the world. We publish on Wednesdays and Saturdays by email. Runs around 35 or 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the internet. And everything that you need to know each week is in that publication. You can get a free introductory copy by going to theinternationalforecaster.com. Theinternationalforecaster.com. forecaster.com. You can also go to www.intforecaster.com. That's intforecaster.com. If you'd like to ask a question and we answer everyone, or get a copy of the publication, or get a copy of our latest releases on gold and silver shares, all you have to do is email us, and that address is Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com, Bob at intforecaster.com. For those of you who would like to call toll-free, that number is 877-479-8178, 877-479-8178. You can get either copy there, and they have a special there for those of you who want to become subscribers. It's a free one-year subscription. The offer that they're making is really terrific, so if you want to be a subscriber, take advantage of it.
Excellent. Well, let's leave it there for tonight. Bob Chapman, always a very interesting conversation, and I'm looking forward to many more of them in the new year. So thank you once again for your time.
Well, you're welcome, and I will see you again next week.